father of the student body and the vice father. And I think now we can call up the uncle of the students, our dean of students, Dean Chandler.
Old Uncle Everett. I'm very grateful to the conference planning committee here because they really made quite a display for our panel this afternoon on personal survival when they built this smudge here and made a real test for the people who were sitting over here. The symposium, and that's what we'll have this panel will be called this afternoon, is on the topic of personal survival. And this is, of course, closely related to academic survival. In fact, it probably is true that more people drop out academically as a result of personal reasons than perhaps for straight failure in academic subjects. Those who attended the conference last year will hear much repeated. Your conference committee, when they evaluated last year's program, asked that the survival element be brought forth again. Well, let us hope then that the repeat for those who've heard it before will be reinforcement, and that you will be able then to better convey the information to those new students that will be with us right away. The members of the symposium here are Mrs. Eiler, who works in the area of financial aids, obviously very important to survival of students. Next, Dr. Mounts. On all too many occasions, let's say he literally is involved in the survival of students. And on the far right, Dr. Lorraine Howard, who is going to talk about academic survival because there really are some things that can be done about academic survival, and she will explain them at her part of the program. It was indicated before, and I think it bears repeating. Let us put you at ease. We're not talking to you here. We're talking really through you. You people have survived. I don't think there's much doubt you will survive. You're a chosen group, and I think highly capable. We aren't talking to you at all about some of these things. Of course, if we are, then listen. What do you really mean by personal survival? Well, I hope we don't mean that we've made college a test of grimness and hardship endurance to the point where it's just a problem to live through it. We do recognize that there are many, many personal factors that play a very strong part in one's staying power in college. The persistence factor. The dropout leaves because of these personal elements, at least in many, many, many cases. The word survival does have a sound of grimness to it, and I don't think we want to totally dispel that idea of grimness any more than we want to overemphasize it. As I said before, each one of you is selected. You've been carefully selected. You're to play a very key role in an important college function, the orientation of new students. How well you do your job in the next several days will make a difference. It will make a difference in how successful many of our new students will be. And you've only got about the next week to do it. Now let's think a little bit about these new students. Let's think about the failure or the personal loss and the economic loss that comes of the failure of a dropout. This disturbs us as educators. Dr. Fisher mentioned that. He said that he doesn't like to sign a letter of dismissal. It bothers him. He didn't become a dean to write letters of dismissal. It bothers all of us when a student does not succeed. We accepted our job here as educators, not diseducators. Let's think a little bit about the economic factor of this and what you might play in this side. The state of California puts up, let's say it's roughly $1,200 per student. For every one of you and for every one of the students coming in to college. Let us just say, through your efforts, you are able to save 100 students. It's $120,000. Or in other words, you will have made the expenditure of that amount economically useful. So you can see that you're your job here has a price tag of some considerable value. Again, I wouldn't want to overemphasize the dollar side of this. I think all of you here, you wouldn't be here if you didn't recognize the human factors as more important than the dollar factors alone. I think that's why you've come back early, that's why you're here. It was not economical for you to come back early, certainly. You came back because you recognized other kinds of things, and they were the human factors. I've been asked today to discuss, in some little degree, the area of freedom and responsibility. This touches largely upon the things that President Kennedy had mentioned, too, earlier here today. When we talk about freedom and responsibility, inevitably we must talk about rules and regulations and laws, because these are the things that it many times boils down to. It involves discipline. But also, let's recognize that it covers a far broader area. It covers the degree requirements that were mentioned in your academic survival section, the delegation of power to you as the Student Affairs Council and your governmental agencies in the student body, and even, as an example, your eligibility to participate in intercollegiate athletics. Rules and regulations apply many places. Let's examine briefly the need for these rules and regulations. Let's understand together that freedom is not the opposite of tyranny or regimentation. The direct opposite of tyranny is anarchy. No society has been able to exist, at least operate effectively, in a state of anarchy for more than a brief interlude. We equate here freedom with democracy, and democracy is a condition of constant compromise between the rights of the individual and the rights of the group, or between separate groups. And this includes our academic democracy. I will repeat in part what the President has said, because I think it's important, very important for all of us to know this. In college, the partners to this compromise are you, the students, the faculty, the administration. But don't forget, we have other partners too. We've got your parents. They're partners to any compromises that we must reach. The state, through its various offices. And for us who live in a community, and let's face it, we overwhelm a community when a college as big as ours is located in a small town. We have to draw in at partners of our compromise, the citizens and official bodies in this community. There's a strong place for us to recognize we have to give a little, and they do too, but we have to draw them in the compromises we make in our academic democracy. To achieve a happy state and democratic balance with so many and diverse elements is going to be a never-ending task. It's going to require sound thinking and coordination and this communication that the President emphasized so strongly and so well. We do need to work together. Now, we have worked together in the past. We've done things together in the past with our faculty and our students and our administration working together, and there's no reason we can't continue and improve upon it in the future. Let's understand, in doing this, no one gets his own way all of the time. This explains maybe the background of freedom and responsibility as we see it in our setting. Because of its emotional impact, let's examine a small portion of this total subject, and this is college discipline. It may provide a basis for some of the discussions you will have with your Welcome Week groups. I think I can state, having seen a good many discipline cases in the last 17 years, that such cases result almost entirely from some irresponsible action, some thoughtless action, impulsive action. Discipline is only applied in college or really anywhere else when somebody violates a law or rule or regulation or some moray of the society in which they are found. You should be prepared to discuss this with your WOW counselees. You can help them understand their personal survival in college may be directly and literally involved in their knowledge of these rules and regulations. Let's take a look briefly at the types of discipline assessed and how we go about doing it. The code provides for expulsion. Expulsion is a permanent dismissal from college. We seldom use it. We have expelled some students, one for forcible rape, one who beat up an 80-year-old man and stole $45,000 from him, and he really beat him severely, and his wife, his 60-some-year-old wife, beat him both badly, and one for peddling narcotics to high school students. But we don't expel very many people. You should understand this is a legal distinction, this expulsion. We do suspend people. Suspension is a dismissal up to 12 calendar months, and these are for lesser crimes and serious violations of college rules and regulations. We put people on probation, which continues them in college but does withdraw certain honors and privileges. We warn people. This is really to call our attention to problem situations, and mostly for not serious things, but for disturbing others. Now, how many discipline cases do you think we might have? Last year, how many do you think we suspended? Just a guess. I won't make you work at it. We suspended 17 students. And why do you think we might have suspended them? Can you guess the major reason? It was theft. Mostly stealing books from your fellow students. And I think people who steal books from their fellows deserve to be dismissed for a while. That's a pretty serious kind of a thing. We did suspend two people for a very serious drunk driving charge, both of which involved bodily injury, and in fact involved death in one case, and a lot of property damage. We don't think these people should have continued as students. We felt they did not belong in our society at this time, our society as students. We put on probation 53 students, many for parking or for residence hall violations of sort, most of them for excess noise or childish behavior, if you really want to know what it is. We officially warned 52 students. In addition, some of you who have lived in our residence halls know that we have residence hall hearing committees, and they heard 110 cases. Again, mostly very minor kinds of things relating to problems within a residence hall. Now, when we sum this all up, it's 232 cases, most all of which were very minor and with very light penalties assessed. What's our procedure? Well, every person is given a hearing, and he can make this hearing as complete as he wishes and wants. He is allowed to bring any witnesses. He has a charge that's given to him and what the details of it are, so he's not left in doubt. He can bring an attorney if he wishes, and some have. He can have an opportunity to say all he wants to say, and the evidence must be conclusive against him before any discipline is assessed. Now, these are the actions and the procedures, but I think you should know something about our attitude in the college when we have somebody up for a disciplinary action, because I think this is even maybe more important than what we do. As we said, there's no pleasure for disciplining anyone. This is a hard job, and not one I think any of you would like to do. Nobody likes to penalize anybody else. In conducting a hearing, we take many facets into consideration. One of them, let's take one, is grade point average. Let's say someone has done something wrong and he has a 0.8 grade point average. Well, he's not a very serious student to begin with. So we will take this into consideration against, say, somebody who has a 2.8. His year in college or his class standing has to be considered. A freshman has 9 to 12 more quarters to make up any work he might miss. A senior doesn't have that kind of time. Also, for the young fellows here, he's got the draft board looking down his neck. These have to be taken in consideration, and if we don't, we are not judging these things, in my opinion, with a proper amount of judgment for which we are paid to exercise. His prior actions in class, in residence halls, in parking, for example, we have people who display rather odd attitudes sometimes concerning these things, and we have to take these in consideration. You would too. A person's demeanor and attitude when caught are considered. You'd be surprised at the attitude some people have. Some people who steal things, the only thing that they think wrong with is they've been caught. There was nothing wrong in taking the things to begin with. You can't help but feel this in assessing discipline. Well, you can see we don't kick out many people for disciplinary reasons, and most have committed something rather serious in order to receive this kind of penalty. It's either most often theft or wanton destructive vandalism. Now, your counselees need not fear discipline, but they need to know that it is there in case. Let me go further to say, I think as far as survival in college is concerned, suspension is not really the thing we're looking at here. Remember, I said there was a total group of 232 persons receiving discipline. This is a group that's failed to settle down. These are the people who are too noisy in the residence halls, or too disturbing in class sometimes, I think you might find. They too much horseplay, too little study. On the average, and their grade points are considerably below the average of the students in general. This is the average of the people we have find that come before us for disciplinary reasons. Now here's where the personal survival in college begins to relate to academic survival. I think here's an area that you can help. If a student's playing so much and so audibly and repeatedly warned, he's not helping himself or those around him. He just hasn't adjusted to his college life. It's been said a half a dozen times already, you men and women here have a role to play. I think you've got one to play in the next 7 days. And again, I'll repeat, that's all the time really you have for some of these students. But it will be enough in many cases. You've got to show, not only by the words and the things you convey in your meetings, but by the actions you display, what the new student will expect him to do when he enrolls and takes part this next week. Remember, your actions are going to be just as important as what you say. The new student wants to conform. He wants badly to conform to the idea of the society in which he now enters. If you convey to him this is a rah-rah society and that he should be noisy and playing around all the time, and I don't mean in fun, because you're going to have a lot of fun and that should be part of the program, no question of it. But if you convey to him it's a rah-rah society, then he doesn't know the limits and he's going to exaggerate and carry on further what you have shown him. So it's up to you to carry a sensible limit to him so that he will live within a sensible range. You're going to be observed closely. You're going to have this opportunity to teach freedom and responsibility on a democratic basis. You're going to have to teach that the rules are there for a purpose. Now, purposes sometimes disappear. Here's where we do need to bring in that democratic process that was mentioned. You have it. The new student should know it's there. If it doesn't work any longer, then bring it up in any one of many channels that are officially established and even unofficially established to make the changes. You must convey the idea that juvenile fun was great for junior high school, but you're young adults now, and now's the time for mature fun. And you can have mature fun, and there will be lots of things that you can do that'll be fun. Don't read me wrong, and there I heard some snickers. All right, by word and example, you can influence a new student. How well you do your job will be reflected in the way our new students display their knowledge and ability and their exercise of freedom in our academic democracy. Your success may result in their personal survival.
I think it's a worthwhile goal and one worth the extra effort for you to achieve. Thank you.
They decided the personal survival was enough here. They're going to put it out.
We are more or less stealing each other's thunder this afternoon, and someone stole my thunder on a joke. And I had a joke on a priest and a rabbi, but I'm not going to tell it because I don't want to steal his thunder. And anyway, Mrs. Shaw said when she told it to me that I didn't even get the point. But later on at the coffee break, they explained it to me, and I thought it was real funny. But nevertheless, maybe I'll save that one for next year, and the years go by so quickly that perhaps I can see you again next year. I'm particularly interested in WOW Week. I chatted with Dean Chandler just a second yesterday and saying, boy, today was such a great day, and he looked at me a little bit differently, but not because it was WOW Week, but that's what I was thinking of. And I presume from several reasons, but the main reason at that moment I was thinking of that you're so fortunate because you're going to have Eiler at Welcome Week, and I can just foresee that this might be a great thing. I'm not real sure about it, but I am interested in survival for that reason. I hope he survives, and I hope that you young people do clue him in this next week as he comes and joins you, both at camp and on campus. And go back to our topic of survival again. I'm wondering if you young people here in front of me, as well as my colleagues, realize how many financial aids there are available for our college students today in America. It amazes you when you know the complete and whole story, and of course I can't give that to you this afternoon, there isn't time. Many of you were in town last Saturday perhaps, and many of you were not, but did you notice the ad in the Telegram Tribune that read in essence, if your boy can supply the grades, we can supply the cash. Well, this was an ad for an insurance company, and that's beside the point, but isn't that just almost what we're talking about this afternoon, along with other kinds of survival, of course, too. But if your colleague or you or your freshman or your transfer student has the grades and needs financial help, I hope that you will encourage them to come to the placement office where we are located, where we work on financial aids also, and get financial help. I'm going to review briefly, very briefly, the programs that we have available for you students and for your colleagues. And many of you will be acquainted with some of these, and perhaps some of them you will not be acquainted with. First, we have the what we call our 30-day, $30 emergency loan. And this is available to all students that need this help. And as you can tell, it's $30 in 30 days, and we want it paid back in 30 days. And then you have the privilege of course, reborrowing. And we did this through our office 1,800 times last year for this particular loan. So some of the students were busy coming in and out, as you can see. Then secondly, we have what we call our one-year or perhaps a long-term loan, but it's a one-year loan due on September 1st after you borrow the money, whenever you borrow it. And this will go up to $200. And this, you do need a cosigner and so on, but it is a big help to many students. Then we have three long-range loan programs. The National Defense Program, I think most of you have a general idea of what it's about, and perhaps some of you are in the program. This is a federally financed program mainly, and has been available for several years to the students of the United States. Last Christmas Eve, I was in a group and met a young man that had just returned from the Peace Corps, and was delighted to know that he was a Cal Poly graduate in animal husbandry. And in the course of our conversations and introductions and so on, he said to me, he said, you know, Mrs. Eiler, that if I had not received the National Defense loans while attending Cal Poly, I would not have been able to graduate. And I'm sure he meant that in all sincerity. And of course, that's why we are delighted to have these programs, so we can help our students in this respect to graduate from Cal Poly. The second long-range loan program is the United Student Aid Fund Loan Program, which you must get approval through our office, and then is financed through the banks. And then the third and newest program, which perhaps you have not heard of, is the California State Guaranteed Loan Program, and you must be a California resident to apply for this, as well as a full-time student, which is the requirement of all programs. This program is one that was explained to me by one of the officials of the federal government. Mainly is here to help the parents, and I really believe this to be so. Not only to help the students, of course, but also to help the parents, because it, we might say, is the easiest program for you to borrow on. Then we have our Educational Opportunity Grant Program. This is a program that has been started, last year was the first year for it, to help the student that comes from, we would call them the poverty homes, or the very low income. And the federal government has set up exact regulations as to whom should receive this money and how much, and we of course follow their directions on this particular program. The student is given the money, he does not have to pay it back. Another program is the Work Study Program. This is in parallel with our regular student assistant jobs, except the student must qualify with a financial need, again, regulations set up by the government. We had 217 students on this program working at Cal Poly last year. Now, with these programs, for many of our students, we can make what we call a package deal, and this is really true, and we use a figure of approximately $1,600 for 3 quarters for a student, a single student, to attend Cal Poly. And if the student has, we'll say, no money from home, he can get complete help through the different programs by combining perhaps National Defense Loan, a grant, and the work-study program. And of course, we would expect him to help himself and hope that he would have some summer earnings or perhaps some savings. But sometimes, for various reasons, they can't even have that. And then we can go the complete $1,600 to help this student. But this is the student that really comes from the home where they can get no help from their parents. Then last program that we have, of course, are our scholarships. And last year we had 216 students receiving scholarships through our office. Many, many students received scholarships other than those, of course. This was worth approximately $77,000 through Cal Poly. It was interesting to me on the Miss America program a week or two ago that the lady was saying that nationally they have given out $500,000 worth of scholarships to Miss America winners, and at the local and county and state levels, $700 million worth of scholarships have been given to the winners. So pays to be beautiful in some respects, probably in all respects, come to think about it. Briefly, this is the financial aid program at Cal Poly, and of course these programs can start with the freshman, continue right through graduate school, and we hope that we are helping every student that needs help. And of course, again, this word of communication comes into play. In fact, I wish we could communicate right down to the 9th and 10th grader to tell them that these opportunities are here, and that of course, again, they must get the grades so they can be admitted to Cal Poly and the state colleges and so on. But once they are admitted, and we're certainly able to step in and help them financially. Briefly, in order to get these programs underway, of course, a student must apply. If we had a great deal of time, we would go out looking for these people that need help, but we don't have that kind of time, and so most of the time we have to rely on the student coming to us and applying. He fills out an application, and this, of course, shows his budget, income and expenses, as he anticipates. And again, I say we use a figure of $1,600, roughly, for a single student. Then he must, or he has the privilege of attaching a statement of need, so that he or she may explain any special circumstances that might change our way of thinking on whether or not he should have a loan or be on the work-study program or so on. And then third, on most programs, we require what we call a parent's confidential statement. And this is something that the parents aren't just real crazy about, but we hear this from all sides, but most parents are happy to do it so that their student can receive help financially. Then last but not least, beyond these programs, we have the regular part-time jobs in the placement office, which assist many, many students. And I looked at the number today, and up to today, from July 1st, we've had 275 different jobs listed with us for students, not work-study jobs, and that's just from July 1st until today. That's a lot of jobs, 275. And that, of course, is when we'd say the majority of our students were not on campus. So that if any of these things can be of assistance to you, and particularly to tell your freshmen about these things, because they may or may not be aware that we exist even, if any of these things can be of assistance, why please encourage your freshmen, your transfer students, your friends, your roommate, and yourself to come in and see us. And remember, when you come to the placement office to see about jobs or to talk to us about financial help of any kind, you're coming to a business office. We hope that you will come groomed and looking the way that you should when you enter a business office, and we certainly look forward to having you come. Have a good year, all of you, and thank you very much.
One of the pleasures in being here again is to hear this subject from Mary Eilers that is dear to my heart, financial aid. I was hoping she would tell us something about package deals for needy and worthy staff members. And I really was thinking, Mary, of something more practical, such as passing the hat, maybe. And if you have that idea, let's do it now before this next part of the program.
Yes, they
I say that for a very specific reason, because I came armed with a story that is worthy of being shared, I hope. After telling the story, however, I may not receive another invitation from Dr. Lawson to return. In fact, the dean may ask me to leave this afternoon. However, this story is germane to the subject of survival in that it deals with that time immediately after the last H-bomb, after it had come and gone. There was apparently a single survivor, a little male monkey. Now, he wandered aimlessly for a couple of weeks with no one to love him and no one for him to love. As if this were not bad enough in itself, he became hungry, and progressively so, three times each day. Finally, at the end of this two-week period, he found another monkey, and as the story would have it, a female, and a tender young thing, as if that would matter at this juncture. Of course, in seeing her, he was elated, and he rushed to her and threw his arms about her. And contrary to what your professor of biology may have led you to believe, the first thing he asked was if she'd found something to eat. The answer was in the affirmative, as she described this garden that she had found. And she described it further as a demi-paradise. And growing therein was an apple tree, bearing fruit. At this point, he interrupted, "Oh no, not that routine again." So much for that type survival. Now, you have survived this academic arena since I was last there. There's not a great deal of first-hand information that I could relate to you. At the very best, I can only remind you of that which you know, but hopefully can do so in an analytical manner that might allow you to regroup some thinking, and hopefully to make this wow experience more meaningful. I think the easiest way for your student health physician to approach the problem would be merely to list the 10 leading causes of death of college-age students. I think it important for you to know something about this list. However, to approach it along this scope of least resistance, I think, would be to terribly shortchange it. Because it's true that each year we will lose half a dozen or so students tragically, according to this mortality list. But I think of equal seriousness is the student that is lost for reasons of morbidity other than mortality. These things that tend to grind students down into ineffectiveness as students, indeed as human beings. What are some of these things? What of the mechanism of action? And knowing this, what then can be done to prevent or treat these things? Now, answers to these towering questions will certainly tax, if not totally consume, the time allowed me for it. But let's start in that direction. What are these conditions of stress? We're thinking in terms of those bodily symptoms that result from the daily grind of merely living. The price we pay for being civilized, if you will. The penalty we pay for living in a complex, competitive society. I think it important to a symposium such as this to consider these deterrents to human endeavor and function, because as students you must be able to achieve and perform. And these are deterrents to that end. We're thinking then of psychosomatic medicine, of mind-body related conditions that interfere in your reach for your educational objective. And I think actually this is more prevalent than things such as the common cold. So it's vitally important for us to develop some understanding of it. And what specifically are these diseases of stress? that plague young adults. I have in mind the anxiety reactions, the depressive states, and then that gamut of symptoms that run from head to foot, literally and figuratively. Migraine and tension headaches, non-allergic asthma, for example, peptic ulcers, colitis, neurodermatitis, or nervous itch, if you will. The sum total of all of these things, even infectious mononucleosis, or mono. We used to think of this as a pleasant thing called the kissing disease, but now it's a condition of stress. I think it's also important for us to understand something of the mechanism of action of these things, and it's more than just of academic interest to know this, because in knowing, I think one overcomes the first hurdle in doing something about it. It's rather difficult from a podium such as this to convey a feeling of abstraction such as psychosomatic medicine, but I'd like to try by borrowing the concept from the physicist of opposing forces. Let's use the analogy of an arrow tending toward a target as a symbol for a student striving for his goals. And I'm implying by this two forces. That which comes from within, the thing called motivation, perhaps, and Dr. Howard will, I'm sure, elaborate on that. This is the force from within meeting those forces that tend to obstruct, many times unbeknown, but the educational process itself, even deans, our faculty members, our physicians, our girlfriends and boyfriends, finances. These are the things comprising that second force. The meeting of the two allows a friction. It's the heat therefrom that allows these conditions of stress. So much for that mechanism of action. I've sworn at the darkness under this banner of the conditions of stress. How can we, in the 4 or 5 minutes left to me, light a candle? And I think this candle can best be illuminated by approaching it in a retrospective manner. Let's view a student who has risen above this heat and friction of his surroundings. He is tending toward his goals and doing so effectively, and the chances are pretty good that he has had counseling somewhere along the line. It may be in the dean's office, it could be in the counseling center, the health center, his advisors, his WOW leaders, any number of people contribute toward that end. But in the process of overcoming, of rising above this, he actually has taken 3 steps in that transformation. As a result of counseling, he has developed a better understanding of himself, is number one. Number two, he is able to project this more valid image in a positive manner. And thirdly, his actions are those more of moderation. So much for generalities. Let's get down to the specifics in the form of some case histories. Mary Eilers used a case history as an example that brought the point to bear rather nicely, and I'd like to follow in the same footstep. The case histories to be used are composites. You may view and know seemingly one of them or so, but really it's no one in particular. But let's view the fourth or fifth year student of architecture, for example, or sixth. That is surrounded and imbued with stress. He actually grinds himself down in the process of sidestepping a delinquent senior project that he must do in order to complete a design problem that has to be out of the way in order to prepare for a midterm exam. We can understand the stress under which he operates, and we can understand the distress that follows. He explains his fatigue due to this academic load. However, superimposed upon that is a developing sore throat that likewise progresses, develops a temperature of 103, and his buddies find him huddled in the corner and bodily carry him to the health center and literally pour him onto an examining table. And during the process of examination, the temperature of 103 is confirmed. The tonsils are infected, the glands are enlarged and tender. We find that the liver and spleen are enlarged and also sensitive. And the clinical impression of mono, the thing we used to call kissing disease, is confirmed by the laboratory. Actually, he has depleted his defensive mechanisms in this harum-scarum glutton suck of achieving. He's been ground down in the process. I was surprised in leaving the general practice of medicine a dozen years ago for that of student health medicine to find the frequency with which we see peptic ulcers in the young adult. And we expect to see in the order of 36 during the academic year that will soon be starting. My surprise was erased as I was reminded of the competitive stress under which students operate. I had forgotten. However, the individual with an ulcer is one that has many irons in the fire. He is a competitor. He's one that is actually successful because he drives himself. And we might use another composite example of the student personality that will develop this type problem. It's one that has two jobs in the summer, and it's necessary for him to do this because he can't work during the academic year. He's not talked with Mary Eilers, and he is financially responsible for the academic year coming. So he has two jobs in order to carry those 21 units for the quarter coming. He leaves his work a couple of weeks early in order to return for certain activities that he would like to participate in. He's also active in student government. This is the student that will soon develop, or is most apt to develop, this hunger-type pain high in the abdomen that is relieved by eating, that is aggravated by coffee and tea and smoking and alcohol and those other niceties. He comes to the health center, an x-ray confirms the impression of an ulcer. He's one that can be relieved by medication as well as diet as a temporary maneuver. However, his definitive care entails those three things mentioned earlier. Counseling in such a manner that he develops an understanding of self, that he's able to integrate this into his makeup, project that positive image, and to approach his endeavors with the moderation of self-discipline. As your student health physician, I think I would be remiss if we didn't pause long enough to ponder the problem of unplanned pregnancies. I don't know how this fits into stress, but I'm sure we could work it in. Someone mentioned that numbers allow them to more vividly view the problem at hand. During the last 12 months at the health center, we did 83 tests for pregnancy. This doesn't mean they were all positive. It means, however, that in doing the test, there was a certain index of suspicion, at least in the individual's mind. However, this is an improvement over the 12 months preceding that. We had 85. So the trend is good. To further elaborate on figures, Dr. Trainer at the University of Oregon has a study that reveals 1 out of 5 women to be pregnant at the time of their marriage. And of these, 50% are age 19 or less. I mention these things not just as a moralist, but as a realist, and as an invitation for you to also face reality. In resume, Chan, I think I could paraphrase my feelings in this regard with a single sentence. Stress, I think, is a natural enemy of students, and I think they can best brace themselves against it by embracing this tripartite philosophy of Mirandola. Number one, he had 3 little pieces of advice for us. Number one, know thyself. 2, thou art, or one is what he thinks he is. And 3, all things in moderation. Thank you.
I'm really not sure what there's left for me to say after following the panel on survival and then our own panel. When you heard from Mr. Dunnigan that 25% of the incoming freshmen will be on probation by the end of the year, it makes you wonder, how did you survive? Or did you? What have you done that your classmates haven't done? What was the difference between you and the one that was on probation? Or was there a difference? Did you know more, or was it only a chance factor? How did you manage to stay off probation? Or if you didn't, how did you manage to get on? One of the most obvious changes in coming to college is the greater freedom. The student is left on his own to plan his own study time, to eat, to sleep, to use his leisure time as he chooses. Now, for some, this is no problem. But for many, this unrestricted freedom is too much of a temptation. Here, his early training is going to be important. And it has to be relied upon. How this student reacts is either reinforced or corrupted by examples of his fellow students, by the teachers, parents, siblings, or someone that he may have admired or even disliked. Usually the first shock of the unscheduled and restricted time causes a period of procrastination and turmoil. Now, Mr. Dunnigan again recommended that they take a study techniques course. We haven't been able to get all freshmen into this class because there's a limited number of teachers. So we do think that this is very, very important for our freshmen coming. And so this year we are offering three classes on study techniques in which study schedules will be one of these. They will be offered in the air conditioning auditorium on September 28th, October 5th, and October 12th at 11 a.m. Now, after they've seen Dean Fisher, some of them get to my office. And so I do think that there might be some tricks to the trade that we can help these students learn to keep them in school. Now, most students, when you ask them if they've made a study schedule, oh, they'll say, yes, I have a study schedule. And the moment I say, may I see it, do you know what I get? A class schedule. It tells you exactly when you're going to go to class. And now that's their schedule. And I think to myself, I wonder where they study. So the first thing I hand them is a weekly time schedule that's just with a lot of squares on it, with some hours in it. And the first thing we put on again is this class schedule. The next thing we mark out is what time they get up in the morning, when they eat their lunch, and when they have dinner. We allow at least an hour for each occasion. The next thing we mark out is from 4 to 7 o'clock. This is sometime you're going to fool around, such as at well camps and talking about what you're doing, and so we do provide time for this. Also for Friday night, and unless they're an architect student, usually Saturday night, out. Sunday morning is usually taken out also. How many of you get up and study Sunday morning? Oh, once in a while, but seldom, unless there's something pressing coming on later on. Then usually we mark out till about 10 o'clock on Saturday morning because, you know, Friday night, who can get up and do anything Saturday morning? Now, after all, this schedule has to work. There's no use making out one that won't work. And then we mark out time for church and time for this, puts you at about 2 o'clock for a little study Sunday afternoon. Then we figure out with the time left where we study. And again, I'm a person, so that you don't have to go to see Dr. Mounts too many times, it says you should be in bed around 11 o'clock at night. I know many, many students who have followed this plan and work pretty close to 4-point averages, so it can be done. Now remember, a study schedule is a guide, it's a budget. You borrow time, you don't steal it. All right, during these three sessions that we have in the AC Auditorium, the first one will be to take each student in a group through their own study schedule because they will have all enrolled at this time. And with my guidance, they will make out their study schedule. The second class, we're going to talk about how you study. Most of you read. Few of you know how to study. And by reading, I mean that you look at the words and you recall them. But few of you know anything about studying. So I try to teach you a little bit how you read for the purpose of studying. The third session will be on how you analyze materials that you read, and a few of taking notes, taking examinations, and so forth. Now, when I was wondering what I was going to say after I had heard my speeches being given by various people today, Donna came up to me and said, if it hadn't been for your study schedule, I wouldn't be here. Maybe Donna has a few words that she would like to say about study schedules.
Freshman, I came from a high school where four of my relatives were teachers there. And I enjoyed going to high school and got the grades required to be accepted by this very challenging institution. And then my first quarter as a freshman, I tried out for a play and I just had a wonderful time, except that I was suddenly shocked during Christmas vacation to receive my grades. And this is really boring, but I'm the second oldest child in our family to go away to college, and the first one flunked out. And so, and I'm very superstitious. So this was before Dr. Howard had even begun coming to Trinity, where I live then. And Mrs. Clark, our house mother, realized that she had a lot of experience in helping people with studying. And so I talked to her. And the only main thing that I want to stress is how flexible these study schedules can be. And how... No, You can adapt each one to your own particular dating schedule. No. No. Yeah. No. But I really think it would be wonderful if you are more organized than I am. You may not see as much necessity for yourself, but I think that is the importance of these schedules, is that they are adaptable to each person, and I just heartily recommend them to any freshman student you have, no matter how sophisticated he may seem at first. That's it.
You've heard all of the panels now, and you've got 1 week to do the job. Rush Hill.
Thank you, Dean Chandler.
Well, now we'll go into our final department today, that of discussion groups. Now, what we're going to do is to attempt, without any chaos, I'm going to call off the titles of the various discussion groups, and I'm going to call off a number that corresponds to the title and a discussion leader. When I call the discussion leader's name, would that he or her or him or it please come forward, and from my able-bodied assistant receive that number that corresponds to their group, and then just line up here in front. And then the process of decision-making comes in. Each of you have to decide which number you would like to trail behind to walk off into the forest. And a word of caution of walking off into the forest, there is poison oak, and the health center is only so large. So now we'll start at the top, and good luck. Group number one, survival in the School of Agriculture. Panic's on.